For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're devoting this week to rebroadcasts of memorable morning show conversations from earlier in 2021. And we begin with a conversation that was recorded and initially broadcast in late January, right after the inauguration of President Joe Biden. It marked the third occasion on which I had the pleasure of speaking on the morning show with a brilliantly talented composer from Illinois by the name of Jim Stevenson.
The President's Own United States Marine Band will now present the world premieres of three new fanfares written by American composers in honor of the 59th inaugural ceremonies. Fanfare for Democracy by James Stevenson, Fanfare Politia by Kimberly Archer, and Fanfare for Tomorrow by Peter Boyer.
Certainly, that had to be an incredibly thrilling moment for composer Jim Stevenson and for the many people who know him and admire him and love him. He was accorded, as you just heard, a really supreme honor as far as composers are concerned by having his stirring Fanfare for Democracy played as part of the inauguration of our new president, Joe Biden. And I'm really happy to be able to reconnect with Jim Stevenson on today's morning show. We have spoken at least twice before on the program. One occasion was during Jim Stevenson's tenure as a composer in residence with the Racine Symphony Orchestra. And I believe the more recent conversation occurred when Jim Stevenson visited Carthage College, where I am on the music faculty, where James Ripley excitedly welcomed him to work with Carthage students in a number of different ways. And so now we speak again, but this time about this very special honor afforded him. And we'll take a few minutes as well to talk about what life has been like for Jim Stevenson, the composer, during this strange COVID-19 pandemic. Jim Stevenson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, as always, it's so great to talk with you. I always love meeting with you. I'm curious if you're still wearing the ties that you wear during these interviews, or if you're in pandemic mode without the ties.
I am not. I am in all of my sartorial splendor. So anyway, be that as it may, it's great to be speaking with you, even over the phone. Let's get right to the matter of this splendid fanfare, and maybe tell us, first of all, the genesis of how this honor came to you.
Yeah, Greg, I'd be happy to. I mean, the first thing I'm struck with when I hear you even just play that little bit, you know, that was the moment of, in our house, we were scrambling, trying to find, you know, the right channel to watch it on where there wouldn't be voiceovers. So we literally had three TVs and a computer just trying to find the right one to listen to. And we barely even made it in time to hear what you even just played. And that just sort of reminds me of, like, of everything that went into, not just for me, but for all the composers and the Marine Band and the Genesis, which I'll tell you about shortly, but just everything that went into getting that moment to happen is just such a flurry. And So it's really a pleasure just to hear it again in a more calm setting.
Right, exactly.
But the genesis of it was, for me, on November 7th, which was a Saturday after the election. And I don't know if you remember, but that particular, I can say this because we live in the same neck of the woods, so to speak. That Saturday was unusually warm day here in, I live in northern Illinois, and I'm probably an hour from you. It was 70 degrees. The results had finally been confirmed. You know, there were those 3 or 4 days that were particularly stressful, right? And when my wife and I went for our normal pandemic walk with our dog, there just seemed to be, everybody was out. It was 70 degrees. We live in a town, you know, a typical Midwestern town where there's a village square and there's a gazebo and there's little shops and restaurants. And everybody was just out, and there just seemed to be this energy and electricity in the air. And it wasn't necessarily because of who was chosen. It was just the fact that this stress was off of our shoulders, of just every minute checking the news and just wondering what was going to happen, right? And as we went for that walk, being inspired by what I was witnessing around me, I just started hearing a fanfare in my head. And we met with some friends for a little snack at one of these restaurants. And even while we're sitting there talking with them, I just couldn't get this thing out of my head. And so I decided then and there that I would go home on that Saturday afternoon and write a fanfare, not knowing if it would ever be played. Usually I'm a composer who's working from commission, and I know exactly what I'm writing for and the scenario and when it's going to get played. But this was just something I really, truly felt inspired to compose, and literally wrote it in 5 hours. And so that was on November 7th, and we can get into what transpired between November 7th and the 20th of January, but that was the genesis of the piece.
Wow. You are by background a trumpeter. It's one of the things you like to talk about, is that you were, more than anything, musically speaking at least, a trumpeter until I think your mid to late 30s, when you turned to composing, and now that is what has absorbed you. I am guessing that as a trumpeter and as a composer who has written a great deal for brass bands and wind ensembles and so on, although by no means exclusively in that venue, I suspect that you have had a lot of encounters with fanfares, both in your days as a trumpeter and probably in your years as a serious composer. Can you just talk a moment about that and maybe about the role that fanfares play, generally speaking?
Yeah, I've probably played. Thank you for bringing up my career in both worlds. I've probably played more fanfares than I can even count. And at this point, I've probably written at least 10 fanfares without really tabulating them. But it's probably pretty close to that. And as a trumpeter, we certainly recognize our role when a fanfare gets put on our music stand. I mean, it's something that, you know, it goes way back in history. Brass and trumpets, and even though they didn't look the way they do now, but they have always been a role for hundreds of years in announcing kings and queens and for other ceremonies and military, you know, all these things, because we're loud instruments and we can carry outside. So we generally speaking, a fanfare is something that just exhibits certain qualities. And so I guess those are automatically in my brain. Fanfares don't have to. Different composers have had different takes on them. But just based on the ones I've played so many times, you know, most notably Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, I can still remember playing that when I was a kid. And, you know, you just have this sound in your head when one of those comes on your music stand. So having written a bunch of them, I'm often trying to recreate with my own spin that same sort of quality.
I think that what is really tricky about fanfares is because they tend to have a very distinctive quality that you've just very articulately described, that on some level fanfares tend to sound alike. We can certainly recognize really famous fanfares, but on the other hand, they do bear remarkable similarity to each other, probably more so than just about any other musical genre that I can think of. So when it comes to composing a fanfare, what kind of challenge does that pose in terms of trying to create something that is truly fresh and new and yet is unmistakably a fanfare and all that we want a fanfare to be?
You know, Greg, that's a fantastic question. That's just, you know, you hit it right on the spot. You know, the thing is about brass instruments is we have keys that are very comfortable for us to play in, probably like most instruments. Strings like sharp keys. Brass instruments tend to like flat keys. And for those who aren't musicians, this just means the key signature and the scale that we are using. So that even presents more of a challenge because there are probably four keys that brass players just really feel comfortable in. And that certainly varies according to what level of player you're at, but it just kind of comes down to that. And the thing that I want to stress about this fanfare is I didn't worry about any of that. I literally just, you know, there was an image of, at that time, President-elect Biden and his wife, Dr. Biden, on the stage, and I saw it as I was writing the fanfare. It was on the stage, you know, there are fireworks, it was probably in Delaware, you know, and I imagined that vision was in my head the entire time, just a celebration of our American democratic process. And I put everything else out of my mind, and I just wanted to capture that feeling of being American and this moment in history. I'm an American composer. This was not a time to try to not sound American. This was a time to celebrate where I was born and where I've grown up and where I've lived. So I just thought about that moment and let the music come after that.
So tell us about the connection between actually writing this fanfare and it ultimately being incorporated into the festive inaugural ceremonies on January 20th. How did that happen?
Well, thank goodness I've been alive for a little while and I've made some connections along the way. It was literally thanks to a Facebook post, really. I put on Facebook that I was inspired to write this fanfare, and somebody commented and said, boy, you should really send that to the Marine Band for the inauguration. And, you know, they hadn't seen the music. They just thought it was a great idea and suggested I do that. And I honestly hadn't thought of doing that until I saw that comment. And then I thought to myself, well, I have worked with the Marine Band on several occasions. I've been very fortunate to do that. And maybe I should give that a shot. So luckily, I know the director, Colonel Jason Fettig, and I just sent him a quick text. And I said, just wanted you to know, I just wrote a fanfare, and I would love to show it to you. And he said, sure, send it on over. And much to my surprise, he said, you know, I should back this up by saying that I've known the colonel for several years, and I know what it takes to, he's told me on many occasions what it takes to program something like an inauguration and what an absolute crazy time it is for him and just how many things they have to shift at the moment. At any time, anything can happen. And much to my surprise is that he said, you know, I think I like this, and as a matter of fact, it's going to affect the rest of the programming. I'm going to change the programming based on your fanfare. And what he meant by that was he then told me that he was inspired to include more living composers who were responding to political or to presidential circumstances, I should say. And so we ended up with five living composers on the inaugural programs. And so that was kind of cool. You know, that was nice that he had the ability and considered it a good idea to change things up a little bit and get us living folks involved as well.
Very good. And so as we heard announced by whoever that announcer was on the scene, your fanfare was one of three world premieres at those ceremonies, and it was actually the first of the three to be played.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, Peter Boyer, who's a Los Angeles composer, and Kim Archer, who teaches. I haven't met Kim. I know she teaches somewhere, but forgive me for not knowing the exact place. But yeah, they both were commissioned to write new fanfare. So, and the other two living composers were Julie Giroux, whose music was actually played when Kamala Harris was walking down the steps of the Capitol, and John Williams, who I think a few of your listeners might have heard of, had a piece played as well. Yeah. So there were five living composers. Oh, Adolf Hailstorf, too. Sorry, six. He had a piece arranged. So it was really just great for us people who are still living, for sure.
Marvelous. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with composer Jim Stevenson. His Fanfare for Democracy was played at the inaugural ceremonies for our new president, Joe Biden, on January 20th. So I am assuming that once you sent off the score to Fanfare for Democracy, that your sort of direct or tangible involvement on this was mostly just to sit back and wait for it to be played. Unlike many other situations where you compose a brand new piece and you have your fingers intimately involved in the preparation of that piece, at least to some extent. I'm guessing that for a lot of different reasons that didn't happen this time around, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, it gets even more interesting. I'll say I, because the other composers ended up having to write theirs in January because of what I just described to you. You know, the program changed and he commissioned a couple other composers. But yeah, I knew since, I would say, sometime in November, that later November, that my piece was on the docket. However, we did not know until late Sunday night before the inauguration that the band would even be playing, because the band, the Marine Band, didn't even know for sure that they were going to be playing. That's how crazy it was. You know, there was a pretty crazy time there before the transition of president, and there were just so many unknowns. And so we were unable to announce that we were having a piece played at the inauguration until 2 days beforehand.
So I just want clarification. I assume we're talking about the extraordinary security measures that had to be taken to keep everybody safe for the inaugural exercises. Was that the factor that was making this so, in a sense, unpredictable?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Things got so, you know, as we all know, crazy and scary that they just didn't even, it wasn't confirmed until late Sunday night that the Marine Band would be playing. So, yeah, we were all sitting on this news for a long time, and then finally, and I should say that the Marine Band did do a, what did they call it, streamed inaugural concert or a preview concert the week before, where they did a socially distanced pandemic style recording where they did include my fanfare. And so Colonel Fettig, he and I had some back and forth, and we were talking about tempos and other things. And he sent me a preview sound file of their recording, and so I could talk about a couple of things. So it was a little bit normal in that regard, but as I mentioned, you know, we didn't even know if it was going to happen until Monday before.
Wow.
So that's January 18th. We didn't even know.
You know, in the midst of some days that had a lot of awful in them, that's a really strange kind of awful in which all of this terrible turmoil and uncertainty also meant that for you professionally and personally, this splendid honor that had been afforded you, you might have just evaporated. And for the saddest of reasons, I imagine that that waiting period was a really unpleasant time for you.
It was. The odd thing is that the pandemic itself has sort of prepared me for these kind of disappointments too. So, I mean, you know, there's been a year now of canceled events and travel and other exciting things, and that just went by the wayside. So I was, in my mind, prepared just to say, well, there's another one. And, you know, we composers, or we'll figure out a way to spin it, right? I would have said, well, I was supposed to have a piece played at the inauguration, but unfortunately it was canceled. So we would still try to find a good way to announce it, even if it was canceled. But yeah, I've had lots of practice. It's really a bizarre, it's been a bizarre year.
Right. We'll get to that in just a second. So you do ultimately get the very good news that it is going forward. How did you get that news? Do you happen to recall?
Yeah, it was an email from the Marine Band's press contact on Sunday night, and said, it was literally something like, hey, we finally have permission to announce this, and we'll be moving ahead with our press releases on our end, so you are now free to do so as well, you know, that sort of thing.
Wow.
It was late Sunday night, so we then, I say we because all of us composers were on that email, so we all announced it Monday morning.
Fantastic. So yeah. You've already told us about kind of your frantic search for the right channel in which to actually get to hear this, because of course, you know, one kind of sad commentary on the way such events tend to be shared with the public is that in many cases we have a lot of blathering of pundits over what they regard mistakenly as just kind of background music. And so, you know, depending on what channel you were watching, you might have your wonderful music all but obliterated by that. And fortunately, you and your family were able to settle on a channel in which that music was played, at least for the most part, uninterrupted. Can you describe? I typically hate this kind of question. You know, when Brett Favre has just won the Super Bowl, you know, how did it feel? But nevertheless, I'm going to ask you, how did it feel to experience this moment in your career?
It was pretty special. It was, it's sort of sinking in more now as the days go on, because as I mentioned, it was a frantic scramble in our house. And I think I ended up watching it upstairs in my room, and my wife was looking at different channels downstairs. And we did eventually come together and watch it, but it was pretty special to see. And I know a lot of people in the Marine Band at this point too, and so I could see my friends up there, and a few of them had sent me texts and pictures. And to see Colonel Fettig up on the podium, you know, they're just right there underneath the president, you know. It was really special. I will say that there's I do wish that my mother passed away five years ago, but my father just passed away earlier, or I guess 8 months ago now, but I do wish that he was still around and could have seen it, and we might have shared it together. But it was, like I said, it was a moment like no other. So very happy. Absolutely. I will admit that I was very happy.
I should hope so, and I should certainly think so. So how many fanfares have you composed over the years?
If I were to count, probably about 10, all for different sorts of occasions, and some for orchestra, some for bands, some for brass ensemble, some that were originally for one ensemble and then I transcribed to another. You know, they do have to sort of, it's an interesting thing, you know, it's sort of a 2-minute piece. It can't be too long, otherwise it's not a fanfare anymore. Can't be too short, because then it's just a flourish. So it does sort of occupy this space that you have to figure out, but I'd say about 10 of them.
Interesting. I'm reminded of one of my favorite record albums on a now dusty LP in my basement, but I believe on the Vares Sarabande label, but an album called Fanfares, and it featured Copeland's famous fanfare for the Common Man, and then a number of the other fanfares that were composed for that same commission from, I think it was maybe the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra or something or other, but yeah, during World War II. And so there is this array of other fanfares that are largely kind of lost to history because Copeland's is by far the most famous, but it also kind of, and so that it's been interesting from time to time, it's been a long time, but to take out that album and to listen to some of those fanfares and try to listen for the distinctiveness of each. But it also kind of reminds us that a fanfare in some cases, at least, is what we call an occasional piece of music, which gets composed for a special occasion. And then I suspect more often than not, such fanfares often get relegated to kind of the forgotten halls of music history and maybe don't get heard again or not heard very often. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, for sure. Like all composers, we don't really know how our piece will be etched or not etched into history. It's dependent on so many factors. It depends on sometimes just the instrumentation you've written it for, whether that's convenient for people to put together. It might even depend on who your publicist is, you know. Might depend on who your connections are, but ultimately I believe that it comes down to the content of the music. And so I know I speak for the other composers as well, that we just try to do the best we can, inspired by whatever it is we're inspired by, and we just hope that history will take care of the rest. I honestly have not heard the other fanfares from that famous commission process that you mentioned of the Cincinnati Symphony, where the Copeland has stemmed from, but it would be interesting for me to hear those, because I'd love to direct my composer ear now toward that group of fanfares and see what I think. You know, I've always known the fanfare of Copeland's as a trumpet player and, of course, now as a composer. But I'd be very curious to listen to the others and see if I think, oh, my gosh, maybe they should have chosen this one. But there's no doubt that Copeland's is just a great piece of music, and it's important to note that it's also fun and challenging to play as a brass player. I mean, it has, and probably percussion player too, I haven't talked to them about it, but it has those elements that a trumpet player really enjoys mastering. I could get into the techniques of that, but that might be a different radio show. It's really fun to play, and it's a challenge at the same time. So you feel like you've accomplished something as a musician when you've played it, and it also has that inherent American quality that makes you feel things in other ways. So, and when I compose music, that's what I'm thinking about too, because I've been in the chair, I've been on a stage, and now I'm writing for those people. So I'm thinking about all those things when I write my own pieces.
Hmm. We're speaking with composer James Stevenson, talking primarily today about his marvelous fanfare called Fanfare for Democracy. By the way, did that title come to you quickly and easily?
It was immediate, I have to confess. It was a celebration of the democratic process. As I mentioned at the beginning of our talk, that, you know, there was just, it was our biggest American event every 4 years, right? For the most part. I mean, we all are invited to partake in that democratic process, and it was tense for about 4 or 5 days until we knew the results, and then there was just this feeling in the air that, okay, our democratic process has gone through its paces, and wow, what a relief, you know? And so the democracy was definitely immediately part of the title for me.
Well, it's a magnificent piece of music, and could not be happier for you, and I know your many admirers feel exactly the same way. Before we let you go, I wonder if we could circle back to something that you have touched on once or twice in this conversation already, namely this COVID-19 pandemic and what it has been like for you and for composers as well as performers of every stripe hit so brutally hard by the restrictions and complications that have been part of this pandemic. Can you just describe to our listeners what the pandemic has meant to you in terms of your musical exploits? I suspect it's done so in some obvious ways and probably in some other ways that wouldn't really occur to the rest of us.
Yeah, that's a good question, and we've all been through this, so I certainly don't mean to single out myself as having to, like any of the struggles I've endured are unique to me. Of course, that's not the case. But March 6th, I was traveling last year, and I was pretty much scheduled to be traveling for premieres and other residencies and concerts, kind of every weekend for the rest of the spring. My schedule was jam-packed. And I had Carnegie Hall performances coming up. I had performances coming up in Boston Symphony Hall and at Tanglewood, their famous music festival. I was going to travel to the Netherlands for a concert and where my daughter lives conveniently, so we were going to hang out. And I had conducting appearances that I was looking forward to. And all these things, as we all know, were just shut down immediately and postponed indefinitely and some canceled. So it was immediately, it was a rather painful realization that was being inflicted upon me and all of us. And so then it became, okay, what do I do now as a composer? And, you have to shift. You have to figure out a way to meet the demands of a new reality, try to meet the demands of a new reality. And that meant writing music that could be performed by smaller ensembles, because orchestras and bands were now meeting as groups of 10 or groups of 20, all socially distanced on stage. And so I end up taking a lot of my music and rescoring it for these smaller groups. Very fortunate to get to do some work with the Grand Rapids Symphony, which is ongoing throughout this year, where I'm doing exactly what I just mentioned, recreating or writing some other pieces that they can perform with smaller numbers. And so in a sense, actually not in a sense, I've actually been busier than ever. And I want to make sure I'm knocking on every piece of wood near me as I say that, because I know that things can change any time. But I've been not traveling and writing more music than I've ever written, actually. And so I'm very thankful to the people who keep entrusting in me those duties to keep creating music. I've met some new people and collaborated with new people because of the situation. I was very fortunate to write some music for the very well-known Joshua Bell, violinist.
Oh, the violinist.
We collaborated on a concert with the Grand Rapids Symphony. And his wife, Larissa Martinez, who's a wonderful soprano. I did some writing for both of them. So these are things that wouldn't have come up probably unless the pandemic had happened. So again, I'm just grateful that I was in a place to be able to offer serve my services, if you will, for these people as a composer. So I've been working on a ballet for San Francisco Ballet, and we've had to go through lots of different scenarios for which they can do the premiere in March, and that's another radio show to talk about all of that. But it's been a very busy time, and but like everybody else, I do look forward to the world getting back to normal for sure.
Right. I'm really curious as someone who dabbles a little bit in composing myself, that for me this has not been a very fertile period at all, in that I have for the most part, found it a really difficult time to compose music, to even arrange music, for that matter, to even write my blog. I feel like a lot of my emotional and mental energy has been diverted into other channels, and it has been exceedingly difficult for me to sort of marshal my resources, in part because some of the need for, you know, my little modest composing have been pretty small, pretty limited because of what's going on. But I think on a more profound level, I just feel like emotionally and mentally I've not been in the right place to create. And I know that's obviously not the case with everybody, but I'm just curious for you, even in this period that has been fertile, has it on an emotional or mental level felt different? Has the writing, composing process felt different to you because of these difficult times in which we're living?
You know, Greg, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it made me think about something I have said, and I totally respect how it's affected you, and I'm empathetic towards that. I will say that I have found myself certainly more depressed about things, you know, because of these canceled engagements and just, you know, uncertainty about the future. And what I've found is that when I dig into a new piece of music, or even if I'm just rescoring an older piece of music, I am able to find that escape from that depressing kind of feel. And I get energized. I feel good about what I'm doing. I feel passionate about the music I'm writing. And that sort of thing allows me to get through, you know, yet another day of this long year and uncertain future. So I've kind of, maybe this will prove not good for me in the long run, but I've thrown myself into more work because it allows me to not be depressed about things, if that makes any sense. So that's been my solution, I should say.
Very good. Well, it has been wonderful to reconnect with you and to find out all about this marvelous adventure with the Fanfare for Democracy that, as we said earlier, was part of the inaugural festivities on January 20th. We are going to have our listeners hear this fanfare in its entirety. And before we play it, I want to make sure that you help us understand how this particular recording of it came about. This is not a recording made on that day in the open air. And as wonderful as the fanfare sounded, that's not necessarily the optimal circumstances under which to have a piece of music played and heard. So tell us about this recording that we are about to listen to.
Sure. It's a couple of musicians, well, more than a couple, but I will give you the secrets behind it. There's the principal trombone of the Cincinnati Symphony, Christian Janachenko. I hope I'm saying that right, because although I know him virtually, I've never met him in person. Christian Janachenko, he's principal trombone of the Cincinnati Symphony. And then he partners with Elizabeth Fessler, who actually lives overseas in Europe. And they are making recordings almost nonstop, just putting things together online and streaming things. And he knew that I had written this fanfare, and he asked if they could record it. And I said, yeah, you're welcome to record it, but you can't release it until after the president's own Marine Band does their premiere on the inauguration concert. So they put together recording remotely, each of them recording all of what I mean is Christian plays trombone, but he recorded all the bass he recorded some things on bass trumpet, euphonium or tuba, bass trombone. I mean, he played all the lower parts. And then Elizabeth Fessler played all of the trumpet parts. And then as people are doing online, they're putting all those together into one performance. And then they also got the members of the Cincinnati Symphony percussion section So what you're going to hear is essentially six total people playing all the parts. And it's a wonderful recording. So I wanted to make sure to give a shout out to them and how they actually did it.
Wow. You know, I have to say, although I've heard a small handful of these kind of recordings that have impressed me, more often than not, it's really hard to avoid kind of a sterile quality to recordings that are made in this fashion. I actually never would have dreamt that this recording was made in this way. It feels so vibrant. It feels so alive. It feels so real. I'm amazed that they achieved what they did.
Yeah. Well, also a big shout out during these pandemic times goes to the engineers and producers who put all the tracks together and create that realistic sound that you're talking about. So I don't know their names, otherwise I would say them, but a shout out goes to all of them as well.
All right. Well, then without further ado, Jim Stevenson's Fanfare for Democracy. And with that, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today and sharing the really happy story behind this marvelous new piece of music. Thank you so much for being part of the morning show.
Greg, it's always wonderful talking to you, and I can't wait till we can do it in person again. Thank you.
Me too. Fanfare for Democracy by Jim Stevenson. To finish out today's morning show, here's an excerpt from a past conversation with Jim Stevenson, recorded back when he was composer in residence with the Racine Symphony Orchestra. We're talking at this point about the process of composing concertos, which involves an instrumental soloist with the full orchestra accompanying them. I should think there are a couple things that can make it tricky. One of them is the idea that typically, we think of a concerto not only as, one hopes, a great piece of music, compelling in its own right, but also a work that is going to be some kind of a showcase for the virtuosity of the musician in question. And so the question then becomes, I mean, to boil it down to simplistic terms, how hard to make this thing.
Yeah.
And is a given wonderful trumpet player, for instance, especially adept at certain technical tricks? Or when you get to that level of the business, are you just, in a sense, good at anything and equal to just about any challenge?
You're talking about Jeff, for who I wrote the first trumpet concerto,
or in general.
Or anybody. Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a bit of give and take also. You know, if I send the music to them and they say, look, Jim, this is just too hard. Actually, that did happen with my first trumpet concerto. The first version is much harder than the final version, which is still very difficult. That's a great part of it, too, is the collaborative. You know, we're both still alive. We can collaborate mm-hmm. on this and come up with ideas that'll make it give it a better chance to withstand the test of time. But, you know, I'm very aware of history, and that a lot of concertos were, when they were written, were impossible to play. There are many stories out there. You know, the Barber Violin Concerto, the first two movements were too easy, so they asked for a hard movement as the third movement. And when Barber submitted it, the guy said, this is unplayable. And now it's played everywhere, you know. So I trust that if I write something interesting, whether it be difficult, young players will hear it performed and they'll rise to the challenge, and then it hopefully takes its part in the repertory.
Hmm. Yeah. What does it feel like to write a concerto for not the trumpet? I mean, not your own instrument. I mean, and what kind of learning curve has been involved in, for instance, knowing what it's like to write a violin concerto, for instance, or some other instrument with which you are not as intimately acquainted?
Sure. On one hand, I think it's almost a benefit because I'm not held back by any restraints that I automatically assume are there. Hmm. I just write music. And again, it's that collaborative process where if I send something to, and this is, I've written two violin concertos, and in each case I send it to the performer. And in each case they said, Jim, it's great, but there are, you know, two or three sections we need to talk about. And I think this happens with most concerti, but and then you end up with a better product. But I think for me it's all just about writing music and allowing the possibility that there are going to be edits that come later. I don't ever assume that whatever I write is going to be perfect for the player. I want them to chime in so that they're comfortable on stage. They're the ones who have to do the hard work, really, you know.
How much do you think about the audience liking your piece? I mean, composing something that's going to go over like gangbusters with the audience, or do you not worry very much about that? Is it more important to you that this is a good piece of music in your own estimation, whether or not the audience that hears it ends up getting it or appreciating it?
This is a very difficult question, I have to admit, and I've heard different responses from composers, some who don't regard the audience at all, and others maybe more in my camp where I do think about the audience as part of the process. And I'm not saying that composers who don't consider the audience are doing it incorrectly. I think history would prove that there's been a lot of success there. For me, I sit in a lot of audiences because I'm listening to a lot of my premieres or other pieces being played, and I'm sensitive to how they're feeling, you know, if they're shuffling or if they're reading their program or dropping candy or whatever. it means that maybe they're not engaged at that moment. And so I do take it upon myself to try to write music that is thoroughly engaging the entire time while maintaining a sense of form within itself or intellectual, you know, it has an intellectual standard that would bear study. But I do consider my audience, sometimes maybe to a fault, other times maybe not enough, but it's always part of my process. It really is.
Composer Jim Stevenson. You can get more information about him and about his career by visiting his website, which is composerjim.com. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, yet another rebroadcast of a memorable morning show conversation from earlier in the year. This one, Jordan and Jerry Windle, father and son. Jordan Windle, one of our country's most gifted divers. We had a conversation that we recorded right before Jordan headed off to Tokyo to represent the United States in diving competition. Father and son joined me for a most memorable conversation that we will rebroadcast tomorrow. And on Wednesday, author Fern Schumer Chapman talking about her latest book, Brother, Sister, Strangers, Sibling Estrangement,